Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library, yeah. Standing there behind the counter, willing to help with all the problems that I encounter.
Kia ora, welcome back to Books and Beyond. I'm Karen, and joining me today is Anton Blanc, the author of a new collection of short stories, Global Roaming, which has just been launched at the same but different book festival. Anton has an expensive... First, let's say hello.
Yeah, kia ora.
Kia ora.
Yeah, I like the way you say my name. That's good European pronunciation.
Well, I did, to your surprise, you'll find out, I actually did spend a year in Switzerland in my formative years. So
yes.
We have something in common there.
We do.
Anton has an extensive history in social work, communications, Maori development, public health, and literature, with a special interest in Indigenous children's issues and Indigenous literature. Anton is the editor and founder of the Maori literary journal Ora Nui. His creative writing has been published by Tandem Press, Huia Publishers, Turbine, and Overland. So that's the official background, the potted bio, as we call it.
Yes.
But I thought you might tell me some more about your formation, also in terms of your family, and which I know is a creative family. I know from working in the library that your mother and your sister are both poets.
Yes. So I have a Swiss father and a Maori mother, and both of those aspects of my identity are very present in the short story collection. And my mother was one of the first Maori to write in English in the 1950s, and was a poet and essay and short story writer, and she also won. It was the first Maori to win a Catherine Mansfield Award in 1958. And both my parents were teachers, but my dad was also a creative and a photographer. So one of the first books I've published was an omnibus of my mother's writing with my father's photography from the kind of 50s and 60s, as well as my sister Marino's poetry. And so this is the last kind of piece of the puzzle to come together, which is my own creative writing, to bring that into the mix. And then, I mean, I do think it's a really interesting story that here is this Maori woman who started writing very early on, who then gave birth to two writers. So, I feel really privileged to be part of that background.
Yeah, the bicultural aspect comes up very well done in a lot of the stories, and I think there's a definite... One of the interesting things that I noticed, first of all, I'd like to put out there that I very much enjoyed reading these stories. They're right up my alley, so they're very personal in the sense of each one is a separate voice of it's almost fragmentary in some way. It's not a slice of life. It's not a slice of life. Slice of life gives you that, is the microcosm of this person's world, whereas these is actually the microcosm of a person's head as they go about their daily life and things happen to them. Mm. And one of the things that I particularly noticed, it's hard not to notice, is the typography and the unusual element of a sort of a typographic play where changes in format and font will emphasize different aspects of the story.
So I think, the traditional way of writing is the narrative arc, where you kind of build up to a crisis and a major change, and then the back end of the book is spent resolving it and providing closure. I think when I went to university, and I went late, I was in my 30s and studied English, I was really attracted to the postmodernists, who did the opposite. You know, that there was kind of a resistance to closure, that writing was quite fragmentary and broken up, so sometimes they would completely chop the text up and reorder it. And that appealed to me very, very much. And I think that's very much reflected in my writing, that it is, it's not necessarily linear. It's broken up and it moves about time and place, because I think that that's kind of, I feel like that's how I operate in the world, that I'll be, you know, trundling along doing one particular task, and then a thought will come out, will sort of enter my head, and which might be something completely disconnected, something I've read about or an experience when I've had when I'm travelling, and that then is integrated into the now and what I'm doing in that moment. So I've kind of tried to reflect that in the writing. And yeah, the typography, which was something that the graphic designer Jenny brought to the table.
Ah.
Yeah, and it was an offering that she brought, and I hadn't really thought of that. I think really adds to the style of writing, that there is lots of disconnection and moments, and I think she captures that really well with the way that she's laid the text out.
Yeah, it's sort of a step further than what you'd done in the when you edited the Book of Your Mother's Poetry, where you had included the visual images from your father, and sort of a you know, a fusion of the two. And here we're making visual images with the. So just to give our listeners an example, one of my favorite uses of this was in the story about a woman whose vulnerability is that she's afraid of her hair. She has a family trait, which is the thinning hair in age, and she's very worried about her thinning hair. So when the story starts and it says, well, actually, age. Said age. I'm wrong. I'm looking back at the first page of the story. When she was 18, so only 14-year-olds think that 18 is old.
Yes.
When she was 18, and then it's Lydia's hair had started to fall out, and the words are all separated and fall down the page.
Yes.
Lydia's hair had started to fall out.
Yeah.
And then first it got thinner, and the thinner the words, the spaces between each letter, so it's thinned down. Then it started to recede, and the words again sort of slide down like a man's hair. This was a family trait. Women in the Fano shared Lydia's problem. As they got older and their hair grayed, they would comb it over to one side, and the over is lifted up. It's It might come partly also from the world that we live in now with the internet, with throwing little capsulated things at us, and they fly by us sort of like meteorites.
Yeah, well, I think it really, what Jenny's done is she's really made the writing pop
in
particular points.
Yeah.
And just thinking about my own influences there, when I was thinking about the kind of comb over, I was actually thinking about Quentin Crisp.
The civil servant.
So who would sort of comb his hair up from the side into a bun on the top of his head. And so he kind of made he made a feature of something.
He made a statement
of the vulnerability. So that's just an example of the kind of disconnection I see, that here I am writing about a young Māori woman in Whanganui, but actually who I'm thinking about is Quentin Crisp. And I apply that to the text. So that's an example of the kind of postmodern process that I go through, that I hope is reflected in the writing. But I also want to, I think with the book, I wanted to give some very clear messages about, firstly, about identity, because I think for me working in Māori development, that the Māori identity is often presented as a fixed phenomena. So it's based on te reo Māori and tradition. And I really resist that, because I think that actually the identity is much more dynamic. And if sort of cultural tradition and language are at one end of a continuum, I'm right at the other end of the continuum, where I'm very integrated. I always have been very integrated. I'm very open to new influences and international influences. And I think I inherited that openness of mind from my parents. So they were both bicultural, but also very international. So I think that's informing my writing and my, you know, the way I view the world.
I noticed, however, that even though this is a positive thing, I noticed, however, it sounds like I'm going to point out something not so perfect. what I actually really was impressed by was that even when you're exploring something like that, then the first story, which was one of my favorites, the story of Rangi growing up in Mount Roskill and making friends with a well-to-do Pakeha boy and going to work in the family company and so on, going to work for the parents of this schoolmate, that you're not ignoring the human cost that there is when people have to adapt to this kind of change and the interplay with his parents who say, we're not opposed, but his mother's dabbing at her eyes. That was one of the most touching moments. And then I kind of feel like I don't want to give away the end of the story, but the final line of the effect on Rangi is he's going to sleep or, you know, thinking back on the, and he's got that pang. He's
the
too
hole
young.
In the heart.
He's too young possibly to know what that's all about. You know, how he probably doesn't know yet that when you gain something, you give something up and about how distance can grow up, but it can also be, you know, can be met and can be absorbed, the distance that grows up. But so I thought that, I noticed that in every story there was, I didn't know if this, I thought this might have something to do with your work with vulnerable children, that you have a particular sensitivity towards the vulnerability that people can find in themselves, sometimes even unexpectedly, because in each story there's an element at some point that comes often as a surprise, or sometimes in Rangi's case, it's kind of more led up to more of this discovery of a vulnerability.
Well, I think it's got to do with my own life experience of growing up as a queer child in a heterosexual family. So I felt, you know, my earliest memories were that I was kind of looking into this thing that I was part of, but I didn't really understand the rules. So I've done a lot of thinking of that and, you know, with that, and I think most queer children have that experience of being the outsider. So firstly, I think I am used to being very self-reflective, but also I think I also have a very strong drive to grow and develop. And I think that as we grow and develop and move into different phases in our life, it's exciting and exhilarating, but there's also grief attached because you're leaving the old behind. So it's a mixture of pleasure and pain, really. And when I was writing the story about Rangi, I was actually thinking about my friend Hotahi Kingi, who got a scholarship to, who was brought up on the marae and could only speak English until he was seven. And then he got scholarships to go to prep school and King's College in Whanganui. And he's now an economist in Washington. And what I notice observing him is that he's very, very adaptable. And I was thinking about how he is sort of quite chameleon-like in the ways that he fits in. I mean, he's very successful and has an amazing life, but I was kind of thinking of him when I wrote that story.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember a gay friend of mine telling me about why gay men, why there's so many great gay actors, and he said a lot of us have been acting all of our lives in one place or another, not necessarily in every situation in their lives, but they've found themselves time and time again in situations where they have had to
Assume a role?
Yeah, assume a role. Well done. Yeah,
assume a role that maybe doesn't come naturally, but is necessary to navigate your way through a particular situation. So, I think, you know, all of the characters in the book are an amalgam of people I know, but really they are me. That's what I realised.
Yeah.
As when I finished and, you know, when reading the book from start to finish, all of them all of them embody different parts of my life experience and my view of the world. So it is, in lots of ways, it's a deeply personal statement.
Mm-hmm. So together with Gustave Flaubert, when he wrote Madame Bovary and made the famous statement that Madame Bovary, c'est moi, I am Madame Bovary.
Yes.
The same, you felt that you were something, there was something of you.
Yeah, I'm Rangi.
Most of all, it was about you in the stories,
Yeah, it was, I'm Rangi and I'm Lydia with the thinning hair. I'm definitely in every character.
And then the potential for crisis is another thing that shows up in these stories, how you're going along, living. This is the, we were talking about this earlier, the use of the third, of the, excuse me, not third person, of the present tense, of telling a story in the present tense, which is generally considered to be fraught with danger and very difficult to pull off, but you pull it off magnificently in more than one of the stories.
Yes.
You're just going along, things are coming at you, and then... Well, the typical example is the one of the parents and the children, which we don't want to give away the story, but that suddenly out of the blue, they wake up in the morning and the children aren't there, and there's been a, and there's a thing that's changed their life forever.
Yes. I mean, I really like writing in the present tense and moving between past and present tense, because I think the present tense brings more immediacy and intimacy. And I think that the stories, they are very intimate, and they are all about identities in crisis. And I mean, that sounds really loaded, but I think that that is life, that we're going along, we're, we have this, our internal workings. There are external influences influencing us at every point, and so our identity is always in a state of crisis and change as we respond to what's happening about us and create internal change inside. So that's really what the stories are about.
Mm. Reminds me of, for years, I mean, if anyone out there knows who said this, I'd be happy to hear from you, that I, someone said, and it made such an... such a effect on me, was the, about when people say they're over a city. So in one of the stories, there is an over it, and there's this consideration of, you know, when you change, move, what city would you go to live in? Oh, I'm going to go live there. And then this assumption that your life will be different. And then you meet these same people 3 years on. They've been living in Berlin now, where they've always wanted to go for 3 years, and they say, oh, I'm so over Berlin. And the person make this quote that that I remember so well was, what you're really over is not the city. It's you're over some part of yourself which has reemerged in that city. You've gone away from it, but it's come back.
Yeah, and moving, and moving actually isn't going to solve the problem. You need to deal with the internal conflict.
Yeah, but not that any of us will ever be able to do that in a totally satisfactory way, because that is part of life, is that you'll be always dealing with your internal conflict, but you'll always be carrying it with you.
Yeah, and I think all of us are always dealing with some level of discomfort. And sometimes that's never resolved. Sometimes the discomfort will always be there, like with Lydia with the thinning hair. Maybe that's something she'll never be able to resolve. So at some point she has to kind of wrestle. In some way she'll probably be wrestling with that for the rest of her life.
Yeah. In some ways, it's like all the personal features, physical features that people fixate on.
Yes.
It's just a vessel for carrying your own insecurities.
Yes.
Someone will think it's their, you know, skin color, their nose, or their being too tall or too short.
Yeah.
But it's...
I mean, the first story about Gretchen, the language artist who puts the works on the sculpture in Switzerland, I mean, that is, I actually think in that story there is some resolution, because what she does is she embraces the very things that have been irritating her while she's been in Switzerland.
Yes. Yeah.
And once she does that, then she feels this kind of euphoria and growth. So, you know, there's lots of the stories, there is no closure, there's just an exploration.
Yes.
But in that one, I think, you know, she's kind of embraced this experience and grown as a result.
Yeah. What is it, Mickey Shiki?
Was that? Shiki Miki.
Shiki. I thought.
Shiki Miki.
I'm going to put this out there. It's probably wrong, but Anton is so nice, he won't mind. Which is a phrase meaning pretentiousness.
Yeah, pretentiousness. Yeah. Yeah. I spent a lot of time in Switzerland, and it has this reputation of being very kind of anal and constrictive, which on one level it is. And I remember this particular point where I got told off for crossing the road when. People. That's what Swiss people will do.
Yeah,
if the light's red and you're crossing, they will fake shake. And I thought, you know what? I really want to tell them to rack off, but if you want to be here, surrender to the experience and play the rules. And kind of once I'd made that shift, then I discovered this other side of the Swiss, which is this slightly subversive sense of humour, which which I've given voice to in the Mayor of St. Moritz. So, yes, they are very ordered and very reliable people, but there is this subversive edge and kind of sense of humour, which when you're there for a while, you begin to discover, and I find really delightful.
Yeah. So they make clock. They're very good at clockwork.
They love
clock making, but they also make delicious chocolate. So I guess that's kind of the two.
Exactly. And they really like tunnels and concrete.
Yeah.
So,
Well, they have lots of opportunities to build them, being in a land surrounded by high Alps.
And they build them to perfection.
Yeah.
So I'm very attracted to that perfectionism in Swiss culture. And, you know, what I realise is the more that I go back is actually it's in me. So Dad always seemed really weird in, you know, being brought up in the 70s on the North Shore with a Swiss father, but the older I get, the more I realise I am him. And I'm also my mother, of course.
Yeah. Oh, the thing about discovering that you're your parents is it's always such a... such a surprise, and then later you think, why am I surprised?
Yes.
But, yeah. So, one of the metaphors for that I found particularly appealing, and it appears in two of the stories, are the little wipes for the glasses. It's so Swiss.
Yes.
The little damp wipes that you rip open a little envelope and you... But it clarifies your vision, you know?
Yes.
There's a very... it's not by chance, I think, that personally... I think, you know, I'm married to an architect, and I'm when I was 16, I actually decided that I wanted to. My goal in life was to become the editor of an architectural magazine because I love architecture so much. So I didn't become an editor of a magazine, but I did marry an architect. The one country in Europe which has managed to put money into huge new buildings with a lot of, you know, that cost a lot by major name architects, by prima donna top architects, and has done it in a good way is Switzerland. Like, if you look what they've done to London, I think that there's a lot of that phallic sticking the skyscrapers here and there and just showing off, and what building has the most money behind it. But you look at what they've done in Switzerland, and it's just... they've put their glasses on and wiped them with little wipes and thought, where could this building go and where would it fit in?
There are a lot of repeated metaphors throughout the story, and the whole idea is that, you know, they're set in different parts of the world, but our experiences are all connected no matter where we are.
Yeah.
But I agree about...
Global roaming.
Yeah, and you know, we're sort of going to the Frankfurt Book Fair where I go every year. This is
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I'm taking Māori literature to the world, and what I realised...
Oh, you go as Ora Nui,
As a publishing house.
Yeah.
And what I realised was, you know, I mean, as an Indigenous person, and working with other Indigenous people, mm-hmm. we're talking about loss of land, loss of language, maintenance of culture. And when I'm in Europe, I realise that, you know what, everybody else is talking about the same things.
Yeah, so, that's true.
So, you know, we kind of think we're special because we're Indigenous, but no, all these people are struggling with the same issues. So that is kind of the whole point of the collection. But with the Swiss and the new buildings, what I think that they've done really well is maintenance of tradition, but they're also very forward thinking, and they're also one of the most democratic countries in the world. So all the cantons are self-managing. They have a referendum before they change any piece of legislation. So I think that they're being...
Citizen is both rights and possibilities, not just...
Yes.
And duties. Duties, but also rights and potential, yeah.
Yes, and being informed by a diverse range of opinions.
Yeah, although I have to say they came very late to the table in allowing women to be some of those who expressed
the last to give women the vote, I think, in the developed world, and so that wasn't until the 1970s.
Just stunning when you stop and think. But then on the other hand, even countries that you expect, like Italy, didn't give the vote to the women until after World War II. I was always really surprised when I realized that. So, you know, women, you know, now walking down the street, were, when they grew up, they weren't allowed to vote. It's always surprising. But let's not get into women's because we're still talking about your book. And we've got about 5 minutes left. I wanted to ask also about the choices when someone finds, when you find yourself writing a collection of stories, or no, when you find yourself writing anything, did you come to parts where you had a choice and you said, should I put this in? Should I leave it out? Mm-hmm. Was there something that you left out that you might be keeping for another book? Was there?
So I started a short story collection maybe 4 years ago, and I, you know, it felt very overworked. And I'd heard writers talk about this kind of process before, and I realized, actually, you know what, you need to start again.
Have the courage to just say, put that aside and start again.
This is not working.
Yeah.
And because I was going over the writing too much and interfering with it too early, and I had coffee with Wishy Ihimaina, and he said to me, look, just write your first draft and don't look at it and give it to an editor.
And
I followed his advice, and it was really the best advice I've ever been given in writing, because what I found was that when the stories came back from the editor, you know what, they're in pretty good shape.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my process for writing it. And that would be my advice to anybody writing a collection or a novel. Just get the first draft done.
Yeah, so possibly when you were trying to edit it, as you were writing it, you were actually editing out some of the vitality and some of your personal voice.
Yes.
Some of that.
Yeah, and it just all became, it just became overworked. That's how it felt when I reread it, overworked. Whereas, when, you know, if you just let yourself do the first draft, your voice is clear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although you can really see the effects of the needing the editor. I'm glad that you didn't just say, just sit down and write everything. You know, there's this myth about Jack Kerouac writing on the road, just sitting down and putting his paper in the typewriter and typing away. Benzedrine fueled typing all night. But actually, the role of the editor, one of my personal bugbears is people who write novels nowadays who seem to have not seem to have been prima donnas enough to be able to say, I don't want an editor to put any red lines through anything that I've written. And you get these books that you just, as you're reading them, you're going, oh, just someone with a red pencil. It's just too much.
Yeah. So there's a fine balance. The first editor I worked with had a very heavy hand, and when you're writing, that can feel like being bullied. If they're really intervening in the writing. So we're kind of like, okay, moved on from that. And then, so you have to find somebody who likes your voice. That's the first thing.
Yeah.
Like if they don't like the writing, then I don't think it's gonna work. And so Kitty Piana Wong, who is a colleague and has her own small press, she was the editor for it, and she's a really good match for me.
Yeah, she's a remarkable person. And I think even you said like your writing, but I think it's also another word you could use is the appeal. So there's something in your writing that appeals to something in the editor. So there's like a sharing, there's some not a reflection exactly, but when you meet and you get the electric shock, there's like something that's made contact.
Yes.
So, were there things that you're thinking I might touch on that in a future piece of writing?
No, I've included everything I wrote for the story, and what I'm thinking about in terms of the next book is a memoir. So that would be kind of back to nonfiction. In terms of what's here at the moment, it's kind of what I want to say now. I wanted to write something that was very current and global. So I feel really satisfied with the product. It feels very kind of whole and complete to me.
And rightly so, because that's exactly how it seemed to me. It's like being global roaming and roaming through so many different voices and places in the world. There is really an underlying voice, as you said, which is me. What was the quote? Everyone is an amalgam of people I've met over the years, with lots of myself thrown in for good measure.
Yeah, touche.
Well said. Well, thank you very much for being here. So that's Global Roaming by Anton Blanc, and you can find it through his website,
www.oranui.co.nz, and at the Women's Bookshop and Unity
Books, Auckland or Wellington.
Yes.
So thanks very much for joining us today, and look forward to seeing you a week from today, 9:35 on Sunday. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
program was brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz
and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35pm on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/booksandbeyond.